Burgers, LLC, a local bicycle food delivery company delivering to the Portland metro area in an hour or less. More information and a list of local eateries they work with can be found at pdxccc.com.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven, serving Portland at 107.1 FM, and K219 KU Nehalem, serving Nehalem, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm, radio is yours.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from our friends at Pickathon. July 31st through August 3rd at Pendarvis Farm in Happy Valley, Oregon. A multi-sensory experiential music festival celebrating 25 years. Weekend and single day passes now available. Tickets, schedule, and more information available at pickathon.com.
From the University of Oregon's Agora Journalism Center, this is the Listener's Podcast. It's been a while, you know, but we're returning with a new season, one that feels especially timely. We're calling it Oregon Speaks, Voices from This Moment. I'm Andrew Debigel. I teach at the University of Oregon and direct the Agora Journalism Center. I'm also the professor behind Community Voices, a graduate course where students learn to listen deeply and co-create stories with communities. Over the past few weeks, they've been holding space for Oregonians to reflect on what's changing right now in their lives, their work, and their communities. We begin these conversations during the first 100 days of a new presidential administration, a moment that has brought uncertainty, policy shifts, and urgent questions about how we care for one another. The results? A collection of stories sharing their concerns, yes, but they are also about resilience, about mutual aid, and most of all, they're about people showing up for each other. So thanks for coming back to listen. Let's begin. So this next episode was produced by Kaya LaGuardia Yonemine. So welcome.
Thank you.
How you doing?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good. So I want to learn a little bit more. Who do you talk to and why?
Yeah, so I met with Duncan Huang. He has many roles that he does, but at his day job, he works at APANO, and it's one of the largest Asian American social justice organizations here in the state. But he also just happens to be a local elected official. He works as a metro councilor for the Southeast and Southwest region of Portland. So, yeah, really excited to get to dive into this.
Before we dive in, what stuck with you the most about your conversation with him?
I think it was really interesting to get to dive into all the different community needs that he's seeing, both in the political representative space, but also as an organizer and an advocate for our communities right now. And as we're seeing across our podcast series, like there's so many things to respond to.
Yeah. He sits at a very special perch, so I'm really eager to dive in. So why don't we do that? So we just jump right in?
All right.
Here we go.
We can't shy away from politics, and we have to lean in. You have to be engaged in that community. You have to continue to learn and grow. For so many of our projects, we would have a decade of no's until we got to that yes. But you get to that yes through like intentional organizing and power building.
That was Duncan Huang, a local organizer and current elected official serving on the Metro Council. He and I have been in similar spaces over the years, but Duncan is what I would consider an invested member in the APANO community, as in he was there when it began.
Yeah, I started with APANO in 2013, so 12 years at the organization. And yeah, like when we first started, we had maybe three staff, and we were just, you know, really focused on, you know, grassroots organizing, advocacy, and like civic engagement, like kind of registering voters and getting them out to vote. So that was kind of like our bread and butter. But over, you know, the course of a couple of years, we just noticed obvious like needs for specifically the Asian American community that weren't, you know, getting fulfilled. So I think we started to, you know, continue to do that organizing and advocacy, but also start working more on the implementation side as well.
In full disclosure, at the time of this recording, I also work at APANO on the election side of things. So we know each other's work pretty well. I was in the youth group back in the day and have only been an official staff for about a year now. But for Duncan?
It's been about a decade, so yeah.
2013.
Yeah.
I can't think about how that was far away. That doesn't sound far away to me. But.
Well, you know, I think a year in a nonprofit is like 3 years anywhere else. Like time just like flies.
The organization has gone through quite a few changes over the years, now mainly serving Asian and Asian American communities and offering different services throughout Oregon. They now have a 501c3, their normal programs, and a separate 501c4 called APANO Action Fund, which works directly with candidates and campaigns to win elections.
we have this like virtuous cycle where I think the policy and advocacy team goes out and wins, you know, policy campaigns, gets folks elected to office that represent us, and then I come to the C3 side and my side for implementation of like how do we actually then, you know, build that thing that the community has been asking for. So it's kind of off this big picture policy of working directly with community members.
Meanwhile, Duncan's role at Metro combines a lot of similar priorities and issues seen at his day job. For those who don't know, the council is much more than just a regional government in the Portland metro area. They run the Oregon Zoo, the Convention Center, the Expo Center, and manage cross-county work like transit lines, all the waste management, and now some housing projects.
I wasn't really thinking about running for public office, but my predecessor on the council had to retire for medical reasons. So they reached out and asked if I would, you know, step in. So yeah, that's kind of like how I ended up there. It's just really great to have that kind of like supportive workplace where actually that's part of the mission is to grow that kind of leadership. So we see that, you know, in the legislature and locally from our board and members of, you know, folks stepping into leadership, which is exactly what we want to see.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's cool to see people being able to build up their tools and then go use them out into the elected offices.
Yeah,
so that's awesome.
Yeah.
So something that I was really interested in is your origin story with organizing in the first place. So if there's a really big moment or memory that stood out to you that kind of launched you on this path, lay it out for me. What happened? Where were you?
If we're talking about an origin story, I want to go a little further back.
Go for it.
Yeah. So you know, my parents are immigrants. You know, they came over from Taiwan, and we ended up in Upper Michigan. It's like tiny little town. And my mom opened the first Chinese restaurant in the whole, like that part of the state, basically. So that's kind of my background was like, you know, we were this immigrant family in the middle of nowhere. So yeah, I don't think I was like particularly civically involved. But then when I went to college, I went to the University of Michigan. Then that's when I really kind of fell into organizing. So I worked throughout college as a canvasser. So I knocked on a lot of doors working on various environmental causes. And then after college, I worked as an organizer for the National Youth Vote Coalition and did like voter registration and turnout. So that's kind of like how I got into it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where was the moment that like it clicked for you that you want to do organizing kind of stuff within that? Was that in college, is that what you're saying? Or?
I think it really depends on your definition of organizing, right? And there's different types of organizing. You know, civic engagement really only gets you so far. I think you really do need to step into, honestly, the political realm sometimes to really, you know, get the change that you want to see. You know, you can organize people and you can also organize money. We have all these like community dreams, community visions, and if they don't get funded, they just sit there on a shelf, right? Like these are the things that our community needs. So how do we organize the resources and capital to make sure they happen? I spend a lot of my time now thinking about like organizing kind of the resources that we need. So how do we get investment for community centers and affordable housing and small businesses and not like big box stores? So I think a lot of it is like, how do we organize the people and then how do we organize the resources? That's kind of been my evolution. But at the center of it, it's just, you know, what does a community need and how are we kind of like building that collective power to get together. I don't think I could just do like any one of those things because they're also kind of interconnected. But yeah, I would say that all came together really throughout my time at Apano.
So now that you're back in the organizing world, what is it like to shift between working as an organizer and then as an elected official, like at the same time? You know, fighting for different things and resources? Like, what comes up for you?
Yeah, it's an interesting culture shift. So, like, a couple of days a week, I'm an advocate. And a couple of days a week, I have to say no to be advocates, right? Or, like, not no necessarily, but just be like, this is what we got, like, resource-wise, or this is what we're constrained to do. So that's like, a weekly culture shift. Sometimes we are in this, like, Portland progressive bubble where we talk to our friends. But it's really valuable to have that perspective of like, actually, this is what someone in Clackamas County thinks, you know, or this is what, you know, this industry thinks. sometimes we just got to get out of our bubbles. I think that's a thing that we have to, like, you know, be honest about, is just like, this is what's causing that polarization because we're not having those conversations. But at the same time, I think it's really important to stick to your values, right? Like, it's okay to disagree, but yeah, I think, you know, staying true to your values is just, you know, really, really critical. So yeah, I think what you see is what you get. I'd rather, you know, stick to my values than, you know, compromise them a lot.
Yeah, that's interesting that you brought up the different, like, almost like echo chambers that some people get into in terms of their political just lifestyles when it comes to the first 100 days.
Yeah, I think coalition building is now more important than ever, especially, you know, sometimes with different interest groups. There's some power to be like, actually, we might not agree on everything, but we agree on this, and we have to, like, speak up about that. When we broaden that tent and do some coalition building, I think that's when we can be most impactful.
You were saying organizing with people and organizing with capital and that kind of thing. But I feel like in our space, like, everything is politicized is kind of how we see things. Right. All the different systemic oppressions that we're seeing currently impacting our communities are coming from policies and from things that people put in place that said that this is how things need to be, you know? Yeah. So it's interesting how you brought all of that connected into each other.
Yeah, I think people are recognizing more and more that everything is political. And, you know, if you can say, I don't want to get involved in politics, you know, that is a place of privilege, right? It's like you feel like, you know, no matter who is in charge, that you will be okay. And that's not the case for our community. Like, it really does matter. And we're seeing and feeling that.
You're kind of touching on, like, things are getting impacted in our communities. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if you could tell us, what has changed for you? That's a huge one, but
gosh, so much. Maybe I'll go top down. You know, I think on the local government level, the changes at the federal level are huge. You know, it really does impact our funding for, you know, transit, highway and other transportation investments, bridges, housing. It makes it really hard to do planning and kind of meet the same service levels. And that actually just, you know, flows to nonprofit and to communities as well. It's just like there's less resources. So some of our partners lost, you know, 20-40% of their budget kind of overnight. It's really hard to do business, you know, just given the uncertainty around, you know, tariffs or other regulatory changes. Like, you know, we're building affordable housing space, but we don't know how much wood or steel and materials like that are going to cost. And that could change overnight. I think on an individual level, we're just, you know, hearing a lot about enforcement fear, particularly around ICE. You know, I think people are afraid to go into public spaces, you know, go to school or church. I think that's all kind of being impacted. Back in, you know, the first Trump administration at Apano, I actually saw a whole bunch of federal raids because the administration was clamping down on the Chinese herbal shops along 82nd because they were selling kind of controlled animal parts as part of herbal remedies. So there was like these militarized responses of like you would send in a SWAT team to like basically arrest like a community elder. And I think stuff like that is still happening and top of mind. So yeah, I think the community is being impacted so many different ways, and it's hard to keep track of because, you know, there's a new executive order or something like that every day. You know, like yesterday it was a executive order on nonprofits and then an executive order on transportation funding for cities that are sanctuary cities. So I think it's just been really challenging to weed through all that and, you know, what's impactful and what's not and what do you have to change, which is basically like everything.
And when you bring up these different examples, I don't know, personally, what kind of emotions come up for you? Like, is there fear? Is there frustration? Yeah. Is there hope? Like, what kind of things surface for you when you're reflecting on this?
Gosh, you know, all of those. I would just, you know, first say that we're getting, you know, worn down, and that's an intentional strategy. Like, even if they can't shut everything off, like in terms of funding or whatever, like just that delay and uncertainty is doing damage. Like, that's the whole strategy, like, is to flood the zone with all this stuff so you can't respond to everything. So you really got to be strategic in what you're picking and responding to. And I think people are just tired. It's been a long 8 years, right? Like, we spent 4 years in the first Trump administration and then 4 years in the pandemic. I think people are pretty exhausted. But at the same time, I think what gives me hope is, like, you know, we've been through the ringer, our organization, our community, and we're still here and we're still working. I think everyone's just more experienced and know how to be adaptive and flexible.
I think we're seeing these themes around, like, community strength, coalition building, networking, all those kind of things. But another thing that kind of showed up is, like, mutual aid and supporting each other.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, where are you seeing mutual aid or this kind of support show up? If you're seeing that show up in different places with the context of all this shifting in these times.
Yeah. I think it's happening pretty much everywhere. You know, realms like childcare. Folks are looking out for each other's kids. I think you see that in, like, food security, especially, like, you know, taking advantage of property and community gardens and things like that. A lot of spaces for artists, I think, have come together. I always think about it through this lens of, like, the traditional nonprofit mindset or government mindset of like, how is this supported, how is this funded? But I'm just amazed at what people are willing to do when they just come together and do that thing. You know that garden next to our office?
Yeah.
Like, that was, like, the neighbors came together and did that. Like, there was no outside money attached to that.
Really?
Yeah.
Quick side note, the J District, where Apano's office is located, is in the heart of Southeast Portland along 82nd Avenue. This area is known for its legacy of Asian small businesses, restaurants, and huge community gatherings, like the annual J District Night Market. Okay, back to Duncan.
I was actually doing a tour of the J District last year, and there was, like, an encampment there, and it caught on fire during the tour. So we had to stop the tour because there was so much smoke. But after that, the neighborhood came together and put in this, like, small community garden, like, on their own. Like, people just came together to do it, to, like, kind of, like, you know, reclaim that space into something that the community can enjoy and use.
Wow. See, if people just rolled up their sleeves and got it done.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes that needs to happen.
Yeah. So I think what we're seeing is, like, folks are, like, actually the government is busy or, you know, they're slow and efficient. So we got to take care of ourselves. And sometimes you can't rely on local, I mean, like, you can't rely on the government to do everything that they should be doing sometimes.
You and I have talked in the past about these recurring themes that we're seeing in our everyday work. And one of them was, like, what you're saying, coalition building and meeting people you hadn't met before and doing kind of similar values and work, but also the value of, like, trust during mm-hmm. these times
yeah.
slash lack of trust in a lot of spaces right now. So one of my questions is, like, what role does trust kind of play in your community itself? And how is that trust being impacted as well?
Yeah. Well, I think trust is everything. Like, if you try to rush a process because you don't have trust, it's going to fail. I mean, especially here in the Portland metro region, we've seen that over and over again. When we started in the Jade District in East Portland, we did that big community visioning process. It was, you know, 5 languages. And I think the community really, like, laid out a vision for the district. And the trust building piece of it was just, like, for the next 12 years, we've been chipping away at that vision. And the first was, like, you know, Fortress of 82nd. It was, like, a community garden. It was the J District Night Market. It was safety improvements on the road. It was new transit lines. That vision was there, but you earn trust by, like, implementing that vision. You earn trust by delivering on those promises. People want to see action. So in some spaces in Portland, we over-engage the community because we don't want to do the actual thing. Sometimes we just got to, like, make that decision, roll up our sleeves and do a thing. And that's what builds trust. So I think no one wants to just keep talking in circles. When you vote for something, we need to deliver on that.
I would love to kind of shift this into more of, like, the hope, the kind of moving forward in the time that we're in. So if you have a moment recently where you saw some kind of, like, powerful connection, can you give us an example of that?
You know, one example might be, You know, so at Metro, Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah County each kind of have their own system in response to the homelessness crisis. I think the challenge with that is some counties are doing pretty well, like Clackamas County, but their compassion ended at the Clackamas County border. They're like, if you live in Multnomah County, not our problem. You might be in the street, but that's not my problem. But I think what we're seeing, which has actually been really kind of amazing, is like folks are coming to the table and talking and like thinking about the future of the system and actually expanding how far their compassion extends. So I think that's been a really positive development. But I think it really took like these first 100 days, this tightening of resources, like all that to be like, actually, we do need to work together to figure this out. Like, we can't just go back to our corners. You know, in this first 100 days, it's like things are changing pretty rapidly, and we need to create kind of a new framework for how we go forward. You know, I think people are just kind of wrestling with that of like, how do you take limited resources and try to do, you know, the most good? And that means giving up a little bit of my own power, my own influence for the greater good, which is a hard conversation, right? But
yeah, necessary. It's like you have your constituents, but then you also have the neighboring ones.
And yeah, right.
All that kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is going to sound insensitive.
Okay.
Why do this? Like, why are you? I know, right? Like, yeah. But seriously, like, honestly, for anyone, but I feel like for people who have not seen themselves as like being a person in these kind of advocacy spaces or mm-hmm, like are new mm-hmm. to it, what keeps you going specifically?
Mm, yeah. I talked about in my origin story, my mom had a Chinese restaurant and, you know, I would help out sometimes. So I'd like bus tables or, you know, make some dumplings or whatever. But you can see that happening today. Like if you go up and down the neighborhood on 82nd, like you see that same scene playing out. And it's like, how do we make sure, you know, those kids have the same opportunities to do what they want? For all the, you know, challenges, I really do enjoy my work. I mean, I think having, you know, that kind of opportunity for young folks, you know, in those shops and restaurants to chart their own path is, yeah, I think that's really motivating for me.
Yeah, the restaurant kid culture.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, our parents work so hard when you have a restaurant. And it's like, they're doing that so you can have the opportunity to do what you want. And, you know, like when I was in college, my mom wanted me to be a doctor, of course. But I was like, nah, I'm going to do this political science thing. And they're like, why? Like, we can't even vote for you. Like, we're not citizens. So, like, why would you do that? But, you know, like, now that I'm an elected official, they're like, oh, okay, we get it. Good job. But it took a lot for them to, like, get there. Like, everyone should do and live where they want and have those choices out of them. Because I think what we see is, like, your opportunities and those doors close. So it's like, how do we create that sense of agency?
Yeah, the self-autonomy to choose
how you
do things. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
What is a resilient community in your vision?
Yeah, we are hoping and are on our way to making the J District the most climate resilient, affordable, and transit-rich part of town. So I think those are like the physical improvements. We have great transit. We have a community resilience hub where folks can go during an emergency. We're doing, you know, home weatherization projects. We're doing affordable housing. Those are examples of like physical resilience. I think there's also like the services part, you know, like what kind of programs are being offered. Like we have, you know, the food pantry. So I think that's all part of resilience. And then I think that representation piece is resilience. In this day and age, you know, for the first time, we have two Asian American city councilors. You know, the 82nd Avenue corridor is represented by Senator Pham, Representative Thuy Tran, Representative Hua Nguyen. And then, you know, I'm on the Metro Council. It's really hard to do something that'll hurt the community in terms of a big project because of that political representation. So that's part of a resilient community. It's like, are your people in those decision-making tables? So, yeah, I think resiliency means a lot. It's like, you know, ability to affect change, physical improvements, and then like the social wraparound services that, you know, if you're having a tough time, like someone is there to help you. So
yeah.
Yeah.
And to bring back what you were saying earlier about like self-autonomy and
right.
like being able to
yeah.
choose how you're going to live your life
yeah,
in that
exactly.
space.
Yeah.
These kind of safety barriers, I guess, right. you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Shout out Samir and Tiffany, two Asian American city councilors. Let's
yeah,
go.
That's right. yeah.
Sort of a follow-up to that, but if you were to kind of imagine these resilient communities, what do you think needs to happen to kind of make those visions possible?
I would invest in the people and the connections that they have, because that's really what organizing is, right? It's like, how do we come together to tackle our shared problems? If you don't have kind of that network and relationships and trust, like, you're not going to tackle your shared problems. You're going to go into the scarcity mindset where you're competing against each other.
So moving into these calls to action, let's get people fired up. Very simple question. What should we do?
I think the most important thing, honestly, is to not give up. I think we're seeing a lot of people are just like, all this is beyond me. I can just watch Netflix. And I think that's kind of like what some powers that be are hoping for, is that they flooded the zone and you'll just like turn it off and not pay attention. Of course, you could say like donate to your favorite nonprofit or vote, but I really think it's actually keep paying attention and taking action and then take care of yourself. You're not good to anyone if you're sick or burnt out. I think this is also part of that strategy. It's like, we're going to make things really tough for these organizations and these organizers and these communities. So they'll just get burnt out and tired and they'll give up. Yeah, we just can't give into that. So, yeah, you know, I used to be like, self-care. But now it's like, actually, yeah, that is an act of resistance and you got to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Used to feel like you could just burn through when I was, oof. Yeah. Workload's getting a little.
Yeah. I'm just like, oh, it's what is this self-care? Is it being weaponized? But like, what is that like thoughtful, like rest self-care mean? And how do we foster that as a workplace and as a society?
It feels like in our work, local elections are really central to a lot of what we do. And so, you know, with so much happening on the federal level, it's almost like we've had to look inward to our neighborhoods and the local spaces to make that ripple effect. So with so much quote-unquote noise going on the national level, would you be able to speak to how local leadership can also change things?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the most part, all politics is local. Like, people really respond to what happens, you know, on their street, what they're paying at the grocery store. A lot of that is tied to local politics, and that's where you can make the most difference, right? Like, I think we see a lot of gridlock or, you know, whatever at the federal level, a lot of chaos, but I think people, especially here, are able to really influence and determine, you know, where their neighborhood and their community is headed. So, yeah, I would just encourage everyone to really pay attention to what's happening on the local scene, because that's where you can make the most difference and you can reach out to someone and have them on your podcast.
One of the last questions I have for you, depending on what communities you have in mind or that you're bringing into the space, what is a message that you would like to give to your community right now?
What would I tell the community right now? Gosh, you know, I think we've been here before and that we've been through worse and that's going to be okay. But I think when we organize, we win.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah. Mic drop right there then. Yeah, All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
This is Kaya La Guardia Yunamine for the University of Oregon. Thanks for listening.
That's it for this episode of the Listener's Podcast, Oregon Speaks. Thanks so much for listening and for making space for these voices. This season of Listeners is produced by graduate students in the Community Voices course at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. If you appreciated what you heard, we'd love for you to share it with someone in your own community. And if this kind of community-based storytelling speaks to you, if you're curious about how to create podcasts that builds trust and sparks dialogue, we've got something for you. The University of Oregon now offers a community podcasting micro-credential, a flexible, hands-on program designed for anyone looking to amplify local voices through audio storytelling. Whether you're new to podcasting or looking to take your work further, this might be the next step. You can learn more about this program with a link in our show notes. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, keep on listening.
Good morning and welcome to the Commons. I'm your host, Hannah Francis, and Julia Moore, your other host, will be joining us shortly. The views and opinions expressed during the X-Ray AM morning show belong to us, the hosts, and do not represent the official policies or positions of X-Ray FM. Any content provided by the DJs and commentators are not intended to offend any specific demographic, including religious groups, ethnic and cultural identities, club, organization, company, or individuals. And also, you can text us here in the station, and we will read it, most likely on air, unless it is not appropriate. You can text us here in the station at that text line, which is 971-220-KXRY. That's 971-220-5979. Coming up on the show this morning, this nice Monday morning, we've got Portland City News, an interview with an underscore fellow, Adriana Adami, an interview with Jacob from Sunrise, and more. So stay tuned. Up next, we've got a little bit of music and then our public news service. We'll be right back on X-Ray.
Lost in a role I play, stuck in a video game, armed with a safety pin, overly confident, my skin is airy thin, but my game is rigged to win. I keep my head up, I fill up your empty cup, all in the name of love, while you get the hang of a shade that suits me. It's not natural beauty, the line of duty collapses in. For the falling tide, make an exit on this sleigh, armed with a memory, surely will stay with me, fragments of misery, feeding off my body, I keep my eyes shut, sage advice to rebut, a blind squirrel finds a nut, mapping out the shortcuts, 20 questions, dexterous protesting, and what a blessing, say you've been manifesting.
That was Waxahachie Board. We'll be right back after public news service.
X-Ray FM supports our friends at the YMCA of Columbia Willamette, hosting Belonging Through Play, a series of summer camps providing kids with easy and safe opportunities for interacting with new kids and helping them build crucial friendships. Additional sports, enrichment, and full-day licensed camps are offered throughout the summer in the Portland-Vancouver area. Camp schedules and more information available at ymcacw.org/camps.
The Public News Service daily newscast, July the 21st, 2025. I'm Mike Clifford. The Israeli military has killed at least 67 people waiting for UN aid in northern Gaza, the territory's Hamas-run health ministry says. That for the BBC.
They report the UN World Food Program said its 25-truck convoy encountered massive crowds of hungry civilians, which came under gunfire soon after it crossed from Israel and cleared checkpoints. The Israeli Defense Forces said that it had fired warning shots to remove an immediate threat. It disputed the number of reported deaths. The BBC notes Saturday the ministry warned extreme hunger was increasing in Gaza and growing numbers of people were arriving at its facilities in a state of extreme exhaustion and fatigue. Meantime, back in the U.S., state officials are concerned. Congressional cuts to funding for public broadcasters could hurt dozens of rural communities across Utah.
House members approved a bill early Friday to claw back $1.1 billion from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is used to fund programming on PBS and NPR stations. President Donald Trump is expected to sign the bill. Utah Governor Spencer Cox is concerned the changes will hit rural communities the hardest.
I worry about the impacts that will have on safety, security, broadcasting in our local areas. These are resources that are they're really important.
PBS and NPR outlets are based at the University of Utah, but rebroadcast programming across the state via remote transmitters. The bill cuts $2.5 million from Utah broadcasters. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Utah broadcasters say the cuts will likely mean fewer regular programs and less local news. Currently, most local broadcasters cover an average of about 20% of their annual budget through government funding. In smaller states and tribal nations, it could be as much as 50%. And safety concerns are growing as New York State invests in different renewable energies.
This comes after a battery storage system in Ulster County caught fire but was quickly extinguished. Fires like these aren't uncommon, but they can be devastating if not handled promptly. Paul Rogers is a retired firefighter and co-founder of the Energy Safety Response Group, which helps develop fire safety systems and battery storage. He says the system's electrolyte can cause explosions when heated.
When that electrolyte heats up, like any liquid, it starts to vaporize. Like when water heats up, it vaporizes into steam. But in this situation, it vaporizes into a flammable gas.
Regulations require buildings to have ways to extract that flammable gas and prevent explosions or fires. Experts are working to improve these systems by limiting how fires can spread. Rogers says the fires he studied often show outside forces are to blame. He notes analyzing examples of system failure help educate battery storage system experts and firefighters. He says some systems are now designed to burn themselves out.
Because the stored energy that's there, if you allow it to burn, it will dissipate that energy.
This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Public News Service. Next to Cleveland, where a Muslim religious leader is at the center of a high-profile asylum case, drawing renewed attention to civil rights concerns in Ohio.
Including events at the Ohio State House and in Cleveland. More than 16,000 asylum cases remain pending in Ohio's immigration courts. Rob Ratliff, an attorney representing Imam Ayman Suleiman, says the U.S. government's decision to revoke asylum protection sets a precedent that should concern every immigrant.
It clearly indicates that grant of asylum is never permanent, and should the political winds change and new determinations are made, it may impact whether or not you have asylum eligibility.
Supporters of the stricter immigration oversight say new rules are needed to prevent abuse of the asylum system. Suleiman's bond hearing is set for July 23rd in Cleveland. The Office of the Principal Legal Advisor Detroit Cleveland, which represents ICE in this jurisdiction, did not respond to a request for comment. Bara Siddiqui reporting.
And the latest round of state-funded Lyft home ownership grants will fund 239 new affordable homes across Oregon.
Previous Lyft grants totaling over $100 million have helped triple affordable home production. Kim Gammond from Habitat for Humanity in Lapine says the funding will support 10 new homes in the next 2 years, but notes the program's future is uncertain. In a tough budget year, Lyft was left as the only surviving program supporting affordable home ownership in the state.
Through these grants, we've really built up across the state a network of affordable housing that was finally producing at the level that we needed to see, and we just took a giant step back.
Other programs like the Home Ownership Development Incubator Program and Down Payment Assistance were cut entirely from the state's budget this year. Programs focused on building new affordable rental properties retained funding. I'm Isabel Charlet.
Finally, a nonprofit is working with farmers in southeast Wisconsin to educate communities about the importance of agroforestry, with plans to establish its first urban site in Milwaukee.
The Michael Fields Agricultural Institute has planted over 400 trees across three sites this year in partnership with the Savannah Institute. The sites include a community garden and two farms, one in Burlington owned by Iris Lee. Lee says the agroforestry collaboration is breathing life back into her nearly 50-year-old organic family farm.
You plant and design things that go together and that will help not only humans, but the animals and nature and bugs.
Agroforestry integrates trees, shrubs, and perennial plants into crop and livestock systems. Lee says one of the project's goals is to raise awareness of these practices and their larger connection to food systems. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for starting your week with Public News Service. Remember, and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome back to the Commons. We've got Julia in the house.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. How's your day going?
You know, it's going step by step. We had a good rain last night. I had no idea. Yeah,
oh, that was so nice. Yeah. I know. There's actually nothing like waking up to the sound of like summer rain.
And the smell.
Ugh, yeah. It's so good. Yeah, love it. Well, you just heard the Daily Public News Service, and up next we've got our jazz calendar and then National Native News, and then later on in the show, we're going to have some news from Julia and I about the city, including some city council updates. What else have you got?
Yeah, so we've got some updates on the fires that are happening in the Columbia River Gorge. And just a reminder on the parking hike that's coming to the city district by district.
Right on.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we'll be right back. Here's the weekly jazz calendar.
Hello, X-Ray listeners, and welcome again to Jazz in Portland. I'm Thomas Smith here with Tom Skelly.
Hello, Thomas.
Here are some events for the week of July 21st. Monday, July 21st. At Corkscrew Wine Bar, 1665 Southeast Bybee Boulevard, great jazz drummer Rivka Ross Trio, 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesday, July 22nd, at Conway's House of Jazz, 16100 Southeast 82nd Drive, Greenhouse Center in Clackamas, the Big Easy Band, New Orleans Jazz, 7 to 10 p.m. Wednesday, July 23rd, at Wilf's, 800 Northwest 6th Avenue at Union Station, Ron Steen's Vocal Jam, 7 to 9 p.m. Thursday, July 24th, at Waterfront Park, 2025 Concert Series, 115 Southeast Columbia Way in Vancouver, Norman Sylvester Band, 6:30 p.m. At Conway's House of Jazz, Carrie Campbell with Joff Lee and Tim Gilson, 7 to 10 p.m. Friday, July 25th, at Ty Lana, 7937 Southeast 13th Avenue, Clay Guyberson and Lisa Day, 5:30 to 8 p.m. Saturday, July 26th, at Spella Cafe at Woodblock Chocolates, 1715 Northeast 17th Avenue, Happy Hour, Laura Stillwell, Christopher Wojtok, and John Moak, 5 to 7 p.m. At Farina Bakery, 1844 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard, Double Dash Duo, Machado Mejiga, and Dario Lapoma, 8 to 10 p.m. Sunday, July 27th, at Joe Bard Rotisserie at Papa Haydn, 715 Northwest 23rd Avenue, French Cafe Jazz with the Tracy Kim Quartet, 7 to 10 p.m.
Stay tuned for more info on jazz in Portland and streaming online everywhere at xray.fm.
That was the weekly jazz calendar. And up next, we've got National Native News. From last week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture axed a program that was supporting farmers and food producers. We'll be right back.
The Alaska Desk's Ayulna Naiden reports on what it means for farmers in the country's most northern state.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture created the Regional Food Business Centers program in 2023 to strengthen local food economies. But until
producers. The Alaska Desk's Yolna.
Country's most northern state.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture created the Regional Food Business Centers Program in 2023 to strengthen local food economies. But on Tuesday, the department abruptly terminated that program, which was originally funded through pandemic relief money. USDA officials said in a press release there was no long-term way to finance it. Robbie Mixon is the executive director of the Alaska Food Policy Council, which was in charge of the program locally. Mixon says the decision pulls back over $6 million in investment for Alaska, a state where the majority of food is imported and many villages are not on the road system.
This was a chance for real economic investment into our food and farm businesses.
A dozen business centers across the country were part of the program. Each one worked to allocate grants to food producers and farmers and help them with grant writing, marketing, and business planning. The Alaska Food Policy Council was working within one of those centers.
The program was tailored to address specific challenges in Alaska, so our geography.
Mixon says the program takes other unique hurdles into account too, like transportation and logistic costs. The council planned to award grants to over 50 food and farm businesses across Alaska. But as the council approached the time to award grants last winter, the Trump administration froze the funding, so the council had to pause their work.
We were working with an organization that was looking to set up more fresh produce markets in rural Alaska. We were working with an organization that wanted to provide technical assistance for home-based food businesses, and we did have tribal partners as well.
Still, Mixon says the Food Council will use its volunteer board and statewide working groups to advocate for investments and build stronger food systems for all Alaskans. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs held a hearing Thursday on the nomination of William Kirkland for Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. He was nominated by President Trump earlier this year. Kirkland is a member of the Navajo Nation and served in the Trump administration during the president's first term. In his testimony, Kirkland said he worked on a range of tribal issues at the White House, including efforts to address missing and murdered indigenous women and honoring Native code talkers. Kirkland committed to uphold the federal trust responsibility if confirmed and work with tribal governments, tribal leaders, Alaska Native corporations, and Congress. Senators on the committee questioned him about a range of topics, including lack of law enforcement officers, water, and substance use and overdose. Senators also asked how he'd advocate for tribes in the administration, especially as funding cuts are being made across federal programs. Kirkland says communication is key.
And collaborating with the tribal leaders to prioritize what needs they see are the most important, and specifically when it comes to law enforcement and protecting our tribal communities, I think, you know, whatever dollars are allocated towards the Office of Indian Affairs by Congress, we're going to work to make sure that we get the best investment, whether that is allocated towards resources or law and order.
Senators say the position requires a strong advocate to assist the Secretary of Interior in fulfilling the U.S. trust responsibility to tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
That was National Native News. Up next, we've got the Yonder Report. The Trump administration's axe to clean energy funding could hit rural mom-and-pop businesses hard. Cuts also jeopardize Alaska's effort to boost its power grid using wind and solar, and a small Kansas school district engages new students with a focus on agriculture.
Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. The future of American clean energy is in limbo as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act takes effect. The law includes sweeping cuts to tax credits and rebates in 2022's Inflation Reduction Act. According to
analysis, the bill will impact nearly 300 rural wind and solar projects in 40 states. Lloyd Ritter is with Green Capital LLC.
The legislation will make rural America less energy dominant. I think it's going to hit rural mom and pop energy businesses the hardest.
Homeowner tax credits for solar projects expire at the end of the year, and credits for commercial wind and solar projects will only apply to those that break ground soon. Analysis by National Economic Research Associates found the cost of residential, commercial, and industrial electricity will rise by nearly 10%, 15% for customers in Wyoming, Illinois, New Mexico, and Tennessee.
It's just practical realities that we need more energy, not less, and we shouldn't be picking winners and losers.
In Alaska, the same federal cuts threaten the state's already challenged power supply. Pierre Lone Wolf with the Kotzebue Electric Association says extreme weather across the rugged geography makes the grid fragile. Village and tribal members had embraced renewables to generate power, but he says the new budget creates obstacles.
That has put the kibosh on our wind projects, which we are partnering with local tribe to install two more megawatt wind turbines and another megawatt of solar.
Without incentives, the most isolated communities may remain dependent on diesel generators. Lone Wolf says the war on renewable energy will raise prices in parts of the state that can least afford it.
We don't want to have to raise our prices on electricity, but we have to cover our costs and pay our people.
After years of declining enrollment, one small Kansas school district is attracting new students by focusing on agriculture. Alana Newman explains.
The Polk-Odemar-Zurich District will gain about a dozen students, drawn to their new Northwest Kansas Agriculture Education Center. Daily Yonder's Lane Wendell Fisher says the new program will teach real-world farming skills while still teaching traditional subjects.
This school does a lot to provide opportunities for people who don't feel like they have a place in traditional school or have trouble either staying focused or staying on task.
Kids in the program incubate and raise egg-laying chickens and build raised beds to grow vegetables. The school cafeteria serves the produce thanks to a grant from the Kansas Department of Education.
Algebra can help teach you how to calculate perimeters for fences that you need to know, or scaling up projects from a blueprint to a full-size project.
I'm Alana Newman.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit...
Change.
That was Neil Young.
Yeah, Neil
and the
Young.
Chrome Hearts. Big change is coming. I sure hope so.
Yeah.
Good morning. You're listening to X-Ray FM. Okay.